This is the last session before the round table. And the first speaker is Caroline Fisher. We'll talk, which is from Resource for the Future, and we'll talk about coping with carbon leakage. Olivier.
Thank you. So first of all, I'd like to thank Roger and Thomas for this invitation. It's an honor to speak at the Collège de France and about one of my favorite topics. Okay, let's see if this works. So my talk today, I have recently written a chapter in a forthcoming e-book edited by several of the folks here, Carlo Collaro, Scott Barrett, and Jamie DeMello, that we've compiled together on towards a workable and effective climate regime that will be out later this month. Little plug for that. Okay, so what is carbon leakage? Carbon leakage is the increase in foreign emissions that occur as a direct consequence of domestic emissions regulations. And this is really important because greenhouse gases are a global pollutant, and we don't really get much anywhere if this is like squeezing on a balloon. We've got a balloon of greenhouse gases. Some countries are squeezing down on their own, but if they just pop up somewhere else, that's not helping us resolve the problem. There are a few main channels for carbon leakage, and the primary one is global energy markets. And essentially what's happening is that if you have a subset of countries that are reducing their demand for fossil fuels, so that would be this green demand curve shifting down, what happens? We move along the global energy supply curve, the prices are going to fall. So that makes it cheaper for other countries who aren't regulating or pricing carbon to consume fossil fuels and carbon-intensive ones. And so they naturally then respond by increasing their consumption, and that's thus we get carbon leakage. There's a second channel that we'll call the competitiveness channel, and this is the one that probably gets the most attention. So the idea here is that you have a shifting of economic activity, especially among the energy-intensive trade-exposed sectors that compete a lot globally. And so you have a shifting of production and economic activity and even investment in these sectors towards countries with less stringent carbon regulations. And there's been a lot of work done in this area also by several folks here in Paris. And then there's a third channel that has been more recently identified, and this is, I think, Thomas's channel, technological innovation. So can we have spillovers from innovation? So countries that are regulating carbon, that induces firms to look for lower cost opportunities to innovate in clean energy alternatives, and that may thus bring down the cost for the rest of the world and encourage countries even that aren't pricing carbon as much to adopt cleaner technology. So this has been identified in a few papers as creating potential for negative leakage. So that's much better news. Okay, what are the estimates of carbon leakage? We have ranges of estimates from 14% or even less, 5% to over 100%. It depends on a lot of factors. Most of them range between like 5 and 30%. These are from models of global trade, typically, for economy-wide leakage. In fact, we had the Energy Modeling Forum did a model comparison project on carbon leakage and border carbon adjustments recently. And then we know from playing around through these models that the estimates are highly sensitive to our energy elasticity estimates, to how sensitive supply and demand is to energy prices. That's through that energy leakage channel. They tend to be higher for smaller and cleaner coalitions. And then we also have the issue of intertemporal leakage, which Case talked about yesterday in terms of the green paradox. What are the options for dealing with carbon leakage? Well, the first and best option, as we've heard a lot in these 2 days, is global carbon pricing. So if everyone has a similar price on carbon, then we're not worried so much about demand for fossil fuels shifting around. So this is the top choice of economists. But you know, at least in the current negotiations, that's not what is being focused on right now. Another interesting option has come up, and this is Bart Harstad has a recent award-winning paper on this. So the idea is, so instead of withdrawing demand for fossil fuels, we should be withdrawing supplies of fossil fuels. So then we're shifting in the supply curve and moving up along the demand curve that raises prices for everybody. And so that encourages everybody to conserve energy and use less of it. And Ecuador actually tried this. They offered to not exploit oil in the Amazon if people would pay them a few billion dollars. It had a little traction and then quickly died. There are obviously a lot of problems then with credibility of the commitment to not exploit a resource that you can always go back to later. Then, sadly, the other option for addressing all of these leakage channels is weakening your policies, so having a low carbon price. And this obviously is not an ideal response because it means we're not doing as much as we need to reduce carbon emissions. Okay. So that's what we can do to get at the energy channel leakage. Then we're sort of left with dealing with the competitiveness-related leakage. One option there is, okay, let's identify the most important sectors and negotiate agreements just for those sectors. So if we can't get agreements on economy-wide carbon pricing, we can focus on these sticky traded sectors and so that everyone feels like they're on a comparable playing field. And Scott Barrett has done some work on this. Barring that, we're kind of left to unilateral options for dealing with this. So the countries that are imposing their carbon prices can, you know, take some action on their own. So one is, okay, well, let's just exempt these sectors. So have special exemptions for sectors that are especially trade exposed and typically energy intensive. The problem with that is that these sectors, you do have a lot of good opportunities for reducing emissions, and you're losing those by exempting them. Chris Boehringer, Jared Carbone, and Tom Rutherford have a nice paper showing that this is not a cost-effective option. It also has some issues because it doesn't address costs from indirect emissions, so it doesn't really help the aluminum industry if the electricity sector is still regulated, because that's where a lot of their cost increases come. Okay, so then we get the option of using free allocation of emission allowances, say, or through benchmarking. I'll call this output-based rebating. So you're basically giving these identified energy incentive trade-exposed sectors an allocation based on their output. So the more they produce, the more they get. It's kind of like a subsidy to output that counteracts the cost increase from the carbon price, but you still have the carbon price there based on their emissions. So they do have incentives to reduce emissions, but you lose the incentive to that you don't have anything that's getting passed on to consumers to signal to them that it's a good idea to try to find alternatives and consume less of these energy-intensive goods. So there are some trade-offs there. But this is the most popular mechanism that has been chosen thus far, including in the EU. And then sort of the last unilateral option that I'll go over is border carbon adjustment. So this is the idea that, okay, so you've imposed carbon prices on your industries, and so products coming from energy-intensive trade-exposed industries coming from abroad are going to have to pay a tariff according to the carbon embodied in those products multiplied by the price that your guys have to pay at home. So that's the idea. And the idea is to then assure that consumers face consistent prices. So they have to pay for the carbon that's embodied in their goods. So there are some attractive properties to that. For the energy-intensive trade-exposed sectors, both of these options, the benchmarking and the border adjustment, can do a fairly reasonable job or similar job in terms of reducing sector-based leakage. This is from a study I did a couple of years ago that was published in GEME. So these are the main ones, non-ferrous metals, so this is like aluminum, copper, iron, and steel. So this is with a border carbon adjustment based on the foreign embodied carbon, and this is output-based rebating. So pretty similar. From an overall cost-effectiveness point, though, border carbon adjustment tends to be more cost-effective because you have this incentive for consumers. This was from our Energy Modeling Forum cross-model comparison study, where we find that border carbon adjustments tend to reduce leakage by about half. So, of course, it doesn't address the whole problem because it can't go after that energy market channel. So you still have that leakage, but you're addressing the competitiveness-related leakage. Okay, and this is our model here. We're kind of right next to the mean. But there is an issue that border carbon adjustments tend to shift some of the burden of compliance of reducing emissions back towards the non-coalition countries, which tend to be less developed countries in emerging economies. So an important thing to notice here is, so here is with the an Annex I coalition trying to achieve a 20% reduction in emissions. This is with, if they just auction the carbon cap. This is if they then apply border carbon adjustment and keep the revenues. So they get a lower cost here. But if you look at the non-coalition countries, their burden has doubled. And they do have a burden from coalition countries imposing a carbon price. I think this is something that a lot of people don't recognize, that when developed countries start paying more for fossil energy, that changes their demand, that changes their demand for goods from these other countries, and part of that burden does fall on them. It changes terms of trade. But here, though, if the Annex I coalition does not keep the revenues but gives it back to the exporting countries, that does a pretty good job of mitigating a fair amount of this burden shifting. So these are things to think about. So this is, again, just the sense that we typically have this idea that by imposing carbon prices, the rest of the world is gonna benefit. They're gonna increase their production, which they do. So in terms of production, the rest of the world does increase it, and border carbon adjustment, it pulls back more of that shift than output-based rebating. In terms of welfare, though, we think more in terms of consumption possibilities. And here we see that most countries actually do face a burden when the US and the EU, in this case, are imposing a carbon price. And border carbon adjustments exacerbate that burden shifting much more than output-based rebating. You see here that the big losers are the energy exporters in this case. And for some reason, India is benefiting, because they're a big energy importer. Okay. So for the most part, we're left with trying to address these competitiveness-related carbon leakage. This is also politically the most important channel. It's hard to pass any legislation or policy to impose carbon prices without some support by industry. But you get this, it's a little tricky because while leakage is associated with trade intensity, trade intensity is also associated with protectionist impulses. And that's not why we want to try to levy, why we want to think about border carbon adjustments. And in fact, we have several international legal principles that we want to think about when we're designing our climate policy, and especially these anti-leakage measures. So one is the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities. So thinking about the burden that we're expecting other less developed countries to shoulder. And also our WTO obligations. And these are things like non-discrimination. Like goods coming from that we're importing should not face be treated less well than goods produced in our own country. At least in these WTO obligations, there is Article 20, which sets out a set of exceptions to this non-discrimination principle. And one of those, some of those exceptions are associated with the environment. So to conserve exhaustible resources, protect health, human health, and the environment. So most legal scholars sort of look to that as what will probably mean if border adjustments are tried and designed properly, GATT or WTO compatible. Another interesting thing to note is that the WTO, we also have a subsidies code in WTO law, which restricts our ability to issue subsidies, and there is no Article 20 exception analog there. So that's something that I'll talk about if I still have time at the end with respect to subsidies for renewable energy. Okay. So if you're interested more in issues in designing border carbon adjustments, I, along with a group of folks from predominantly non-governmental organizations, got together a couple years ago to think about what are reasonable principles. So if these things are going to happen, what are reasonable principles for designing them in ways to respect our other international obligations? And so you can find this on the internet. Okay. Now, but I think one important point to make is that border carbon adjustments are there to make sure that embodied carbon faces consistent prices. So they're only a reasonable option if you're using carbon pricing. They're not a reasonable option for other kinds of command and control regulation where your own companies are not paying for their embodied carbon, okay? And so what we see is that the carbon pricing, at least to today, is, you know, it's picking up speed. We've got places adopting them. The average prices are not very high, though. They're less than 10 euros a ton of CO2, which is maybe a quarter or less of the social cost of carbon. So I don't know that anyone is imposing carbon prices at a level where you really worry a lot about carbon leakage, especially competitiveness-related carbon leakage, yet. Instead, what we see is really popular are renewable energy incentives, our subsidies for clean technology alternatives. These kinds of policies have a lot more support and are being implemented almost worldwide. So given that, that'll take me to sort of the last option for coping with carbon leakage, which is this idea of global diffusion of lower cost clean energy technology. So this is what why I was asking Thomas earlier. Are we getting these costs down so that they're competitive in countries that aren't creating a price differential between carbon and clean energy technologies? Okay. So I'll sort of end with a few minutes on recent work I've been doing called Strategic Subsidies for Green Goods. So how do we want to structure subsidies for goods that have global environmental benefits. And it recognizes that there are several rationales for supporting alternative energy technologies, even if we have carbon pricing, actually, and then more so if we don't have the carbon pricing we want. So one can I tend to divide these into what I'll call upstream and downstream market failures. Upstream market failures are things like imperfect competition. So these are new industries. A lot of these technologies are under patent. They're not fully at scale. So they may not be perfectly competitive. There may be learning externalities, so scale economies that haven't been realized yet. Then we have downstream market failures, and this would be essentially unpriced or underpriced emissions. So by consuming more of these clean technology goods, we get an external benefit in the form of reduced carbon emissions. And so one of the questions is, where should we be targeting our subsidies? Should we be targeting them to the production, the manufacturing of these technologies upstream, or to the consumption, the deployment of these technologies downstream? And sort of a lot of the basic idea comes from this. This is going to look very similar to the energy one. So here, but this is, you can think of this as renewable technology markets. So if the global supply of renewable energy technology is upward sloping, and we're in a regulating region, we decide to subsidize our deployment, then that shifts out demand for these technologies and it's going to bid up the price. So if we have a huge demand for solar panels, given the global manufacturing capacity, the price is going to go up. That makes it more expensive for the rest of the world, and they're going to adopt less. So then we have some carbon leakage. Whereas if we subsidize manufacturing of these technologies, we're shifting out the supply, and that drives down prices. That makes it cheaper for everybody, and everybody adopts more, including the rest of the world. Yeah, thanks. Okay. And this is really important. So if we think ahead towards 2020 and where the market for these technologies is going to be, we see that this is electricity generation. The EU and the US are looking kind of similar in 2020. And China will have, you know, maybe 50% more electricity demand, and the rest of the world is twice as big as that. And then the other thing to notice is that China especially, but the rest of the world is much more reliant on coal and dirty technologies than the EU. But if you look down at the total amount of renewables demand that's expected, it's actually bigger in the rest of the world and China than it is in the EU and the US. So that's where the market's going to be and where we'd like to encourage displacing this stuff. Okay. So I built a little model. It's based on some an earlier model in the international trade literature by Spencer and Brander, but I'm adding in a global externalities. Trade economists tend not to think about externalities like we environmental economists do. So to give you a little flavor, we've got three producer regions, the US, the EU, and China, and then the rest of the world, which is a consumer region. Everyone is a consumer of renewable energy technologies. And for you economists out there, I'm going to assume each region has a certain number of producers, but they all have identical costs and they compete Cournot. Okay? So I'm going to couple this with a partial equilibrium model of the electricity sector that I have from some previous work that I've done with Richard Newell, Louis Prionis, and also with some German colleagues for the EU. And then, so we basically have supply and demand models from different energy sources for the US, the EU, China, and then scaled for the rest of the world. To get at this imperfect competition aspect, I've scaled the number of Cournot competitors to replicate the kinds of market shares that we observe in a wind market, where we have up to 15% of GE and Vestas each have roughly almost 15% of the market of wind turbines. And the US has twice the share of China. Anyway, I'm just going to give you the overview punchline slides. So this is the global welfare change compared to no policy of implementing a carbon tax equal to, I'm going to assume here the social cost of carbon is $30. It could be higher. And then compare this. So the optimal policy will be a global carbon tax at the social cost of carbon plus a subsidy to internalize the problem of imperfect competition in the upstream market. Okay, because you have underprovision by these corn producers. They're not perfectly competitive. They want to keep prices high to make more money. So we want to give them incentive to produce more. Okay, so that's the optimal policy. Suppose we get rid of that upstream subsidy and just have the global carbon tax. We lose a little bit of welfare, but it's actually not that much. That's not the big part of the story. Is the upstream market failure is not the big part of the story. If we cannot impose this price in the rest of the world, we've lost more than half of the gains from our carbon price. That's the carbon leakage problem. And if we can't, and if China doesn't take it on either, then we, you know, lose another half again. Okay. So let's compare what we can do to this carbon tax in our big players, the US, EU, and China. This next bar here is suppose we implement optimal subsidies for technologies without any carbon tax, okay? This is just the subsidy policy that seems to be more popular. We actually get pretty close to what we could do with a sub-global carbon price, okay? So this is the issue with leakage. It changes a lot of our policy prescriptions of what we think is the best policy, and suddenly subsidies can get us pretty close to what carbon pricing does. Optimal subsidies here are a fair amount upstream subsidies because we want to make the technology cheaper for the rest of the world, which is the big consumer and the dirty consumer. We want those technologies to go there. If instead we let these countries compete Nash and do what's in their subsidized as to what's in their self-interest, we don't have enough upstream subsidies. And then the global welfare goes down because we don't have, they want to keep prices higher and maintain their terms of trade, and they don't care so much about the welfare of the rest of the world. But then we also lose a lot of emissions reductions. And then finally, if we don't allow them to subsidize upstream, as many would interpret from the WTO subsidies code predictions, we can only subsidize downstream, then we're really tying our hands and we've got a lot less welfare gain. Of course, if this global supply curve is actually downward sloping, and I think Thomas has convinced us that over time at least, it is, then that's better news. Our downstream subsidies, our deployment subsidies, are actually making it cheaper for the rest of the world. So I think that's really the big question. Are we, with our policies, doing our best to bring down the costs everywhere, not just in Europe, but in the rest of the world, especially developing countries that are otherwise looking at very dirty generation options? So I'll just conclude there. I think carbon leakage is an important problem. I think we have to address it in order for countries to be willing to take on significant carbon pricing, which I think, you know, in general, we do want as a policy. Currently, we're using a lot of free allocation, but as these price pressures rise, I would not be surprised if there's more pressure to use border carbon adjustments instead. There's greater consensus that border carbon adjustments can pass muster by the WTO, but they have to be designed well. And I think we need some international consensus about what good design properties are for these to not be disputed. And then finally, global access to cleaner and cheaper technologies can help us avoid carbon leakage. I think we need to think about more thoughtfully about the WTO rules on subsidies and whether we need some adjustment there to enable us to go down a clean technology path. So thank you very much.